The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
On an annualized basis, GDP falls 32.9%. This is the worst number ever by magnitudes.
The big story is tech just keeps winning, and online buying is exploding. The PayPal CEO, Dan Schulman, I mentioned this yesterday, was just ecstatic on the conference call. He said, we've tipped into a digital-first economy. So there's two economies out there. That's the story. It's not a split between Main Street and Wall Street. There's a digital economy. That's the big tech names. And then there's the hands-on economy. Everybody else, services and travel and leisure, industrials and real estate, is basically down since the highs on June 8th. That's two economies.
Gold prices have hit an all-time high, the spot price of gold reaching a record of $1,944.71. That's well above its previous high back in 2011. Gold traditionally surges in times of turmoil. In this case, the economic impact of the pandemic and those U.S.-China tensions, they are sending investors to this safe haven. But the Fed Reserve's monetary easing measures, they also have a part to play in the price of gold. Observers expect more easing measures to boost the U.S. economy, including negative interest rates that could push gold up past the $2,000 mark.
We're not even thinking about raising rates. We're totally focused on providing the economy the support that it will need. We think that the economy will need highly accommodative monetary policy and the use of our tools for an extended period. And we're absolutely committed to staying in this until we're very confident that that is no longer needed.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The economy contracted by 33% in the second quarter. That makes it the biggest drop we've seen in nearly 70 years. Consumer confidence plunges from 98 to 92 as the economic shutdown continues to take its toll. Tech stocks report blowout earnings this week that far exceeded even the most optimistic expectations. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. My special guest today will be former 2016 presidential candidate and New York Times bestselling author, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. We'll discuss the massive off-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government. You thought the debt was big? The off-balance sheet items are even bigger. And how we are sowing the seeds of future inflation and a possible dollar collapse, how to solve the COVID pandemic, and why MMT is grossly flawed. Also at the top of the hour, Art Hill from Trend Investor Pro joins me as we discuss the bad economic news. Art still feels stocks are headed higher and what he is calling a risk-on market. He has two favorite sectors he still believes are heading higher. Later on, Chris Sheridan and I will discuss the possible recession or maybe something worse. But first, let's find out what moved this week's markets with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. I'd like to talk about three key items this week, and that's earnings, economics, and the FOMC meeting. And I'll sprinkle over those major items with a few smaller stories to wrap up the week on Wall Street. So let's dive in right into earnings. To date, about 84% of companies that have reported have beat earnings estimates, so they've surprised to the upside, which if it stays at that level for the rest of the earnings season would be a new record since 2008. 69% of the companies that have reported were beating also on revenues. So if we stay at that level throughout the rest of the season, that too would be a new record since 2008. So analysts have really missed the mark and or the recovery has been better than expected. Now looking at actual earnings, not the surprise versus the street, but what is the actual earning results? And the combination of companies that have reported and estimates for those yet to report is looking like an earnings decline of 35.7%, which is better than where things were at the end of last week. So the more we get surprises by companies as they're announcing throughout the earnings season, hopefully we'd see that level go down. But let's say it stays at 35.7%. That would mark the largest year-over-year decline in earnings since the fourth quarter of 2008. And the fifth of the past past 6 quarters of negative declines, which so far stock investors don't seem to mind. The notable winners this week were Apple, Amazon, Facebook, AMD, Qualcomm, Shopify, and UPS, among others. I'd like to focus on some highlights from UPS because you can't have a strong consumer economy if goods aren't moving. And this was also the first quarterly report by the new CEO, Carol Tomei, former CFO at Home Depot. So some new blood in there, hopefully, to help in performance. Analysts were expecting a 45% year-over-year decline in earnings, but what they got was 8% growth, the best in 5 years. While revenues were also expected to decline, they were in fact up 13.4%. And due to the quarantine and most shopping centers closed, they saw just a surge in volumes on transporting goods, mainly in residential segments, while business-to-business volume declined 21.9%. So, you know, while other companies have been laying off due to COVID, UPS hired 39,000 employees. So UPS closed up almost 14.5% after earnings were announced. Let's talk about AMD, which also had a nice stock reaction on earnings. It was up 12.5%. Intel disappointed last week, so it was nice to see AMD sort of turn things around for the chip stocks. While their current quarter numbers weren't that impressive, only beating by a penny on earnings, their guidance for the third quarter really set them apart, and the stock investor reaction to them was positive because of it. AMD has been branching out into other areas, and they've been doing that well from primarily their specialty, which has been PC chip, graphic cards, as well as CPUs, etc., and I think motherboards as well. So the other areas that they've been branching out into has been data center, servers, and mobile, which includes tablets, and their mobile is their Ryzen and EPYC processor, which revenue actually doubled year over year. So that was a great report. Good growth there in new segments. And they've been steadily gaining market share over Intel in the PC market as well. The biggest where I think where the interest is really coming into place here for AMD is gaming, where you've got new consoles coming out in the third and fourth quarter. That's PlayStation 5 and the new Xbox console, which should drive sales. It was actually not a great quarter for them in gaming sales for their chips, but likely it's because demand's being pent up for those new releases, which are coming around the corner. Big gains in Apple, Amazon, and Facebook after the market closed on Thursday, which led to advances for the sectors they correspond to. That's information technology. Finished up 5% on the week. Real big win there for tech, which had been languishing for a couple of weeks, maybe needing to pare back gains. Real estate was up 4.1%, and consumer discretionary, obviously Amazon, was up 2.1% this week. The area that was down the most this week was energy, down 4.3%, and materials, down 1.8%, despite advances in precious metals and other metals. The areas that were hit by the economic numbers finally was shown here with the energy and materials. There was some weakness that we anticipated with a rollback in reopenings. So we started to see that in some of the economic numbers. So let's kind of go into that here. Consumer sentiment slipped in July from June slightly. Personal income declined 1.1% in June, while spending increased 5.6%. Second quarter GDP fell 32.9% annualized, which is the worst on record. And finally, initial claims was up last week, not going down, which is what we want, but up. And that number has just been very stubborn with, I think, 1.43 million currently have filed unemployment claims. Finally, let's talk about the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, which took place on Tuesday and Wednesday. The announcement was on Wednesday. Obviously, left rates unchanged. No plan to raise them, and so far, no plan to decrease them. But the big thing was, I think, at the press conference, Chairman Powell said the Fed isn't even thinking about thinking about thinking about raising rates. So yes, he said it three times. And the emphasis, I think, is really what was important and what was reflected in the stock market gains as soon as that conference took place. A little surprised, interestingly, because if you look at the dot plot from last June, there were only two members that thought rates should be raised before the end of 2022. So again, not thinking about raising rates. Nothing new. But again, I think it's the emphasis that really the market listened to. He said he expects disinflationary pressures rather than inflation, but gold futures still continued to record highs this week on a weak dollar, which hit a two-year low at 93.46. Powell said the recovery will be long and continue to take both fiscal and monetary stimulus. And he really said that, you know, obviously the fiscal stimulus has been great, but it's still needed. And to that end, the GOP party passed their version of a relief bill earlier this week. But now the two parties are at an impasse because the gap is very wide to meet on a compromise. So the House bill was around $3 trillion, much less for the GOP bill, and a little more business-centric, trying to make businesses safe from litigation, among many, many other things. But, you know, like I said, they're really at an impasse, still at, to this point, going over the weekend, I think, to look at how they can meet on a compromise. This was also a key catalyst this week that helped the cyclical and value areas underperform, including small cap, and why treasuries still continue to hold solid support. And I think the 10-year finished at 0.53%, just 4 basis points above its closing low in March, I think March 8th or 9th. That's it for the packed week, and sorry there isn't more time to review some of the many other notable earnings announcements, which I find fascinating, like Boeing, who predicts that it will take 3 years for travel to hit 2019 levels, and they also expect to cut another 19,000 more jobs. So not great for U.S. airlines and what's going on there in travel. Not to mention, like I said, a treasury yield that has just been stubbornly low and that flies just in the face of a V recovery when stocks say otherwise.
Well, gold and silver have moved dramatically higher in the past few weeks, especially just recently. Gold is now at a new all-time record high at over $1,950 an ounce. Jeff Christian, managing partner of CPM Group, one of the most accurate strategists when it comes to precious metals in the wider commodity complex, joins us on the show today. Jeff, as I noted, gold is now at a new all-time record high. It has overtaken its 2011 highs. Silver also making a pretty strong move, appears to be playing catch up. I know that this was something that we discussed with you last year when you said you had an intermediate buy signal on silver that turned out to be quite timely. So, broad overview, what's your take on the moves that we've seen so far? And do you see precious metals heading much higher from where they are currently?
It's something we're wrestling with right now. The short answer is yes, we do see silver and gold heading higher from here. But as we've discussed in the past, our view has been that we'd have some sort of strength in 2020 or so, but that a really big move would probably be sometime down the road, like 2023, 2025. And so we're wrestling with the issue of, is this the beginning of that big upward move and it's coming 3 years earlier than we thought, or we're in the foothills?
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, here we are. It looked like it might have been a positive week. We're doing this interview on Thursday, where the gains of the market have been wiped out. GDP numbers were announced. The economy contracted by 33% in the second quarter. That's worse than the entire Great Depression. Let's find out what this means for the markets. Coming up is Art Hill. Art, let's begin with the major averages. And the thing that really strikes me is how well technology has done in this market. And you can see its influence not only in the NASDAQ, but also in the S&P 500, which is 30% of the weighting of the S&P now is almost technology.
Yeah, it's definitely carrying the lion's share. And even when you break down the technology sector, the big four account for 20% of the S&P 500.
When you see something like this, Art, what does it tell you about the strength of the market? Where, you know, usually in any bull market, you have one sector that's a leader. And obviously, it's been technology. Over the last 3 or 4 years, it's technology since the beginning of this year. But let's talk about some of the other indexes. And I'm going right now to stock charts with the S&P. Consumer discretionary is still looking good. You look at consumer staples, that's looking good. Energy looks terrible. Financials, well, they're doing okay. And then we got healthcare. So let's talk about specifics. And the S&P 500, what are you reading from what you see within these individual sectors?
What I'm getting out of it is technology is way overextended. And I was listening to Tom Lee speak, and he said, well, you know, even though the big four account for 20% of the S&P 500, they do account for 20% of the earnings. So this isn't like a situation back, say, in 2000, you know, back when we were valuing companies based on a multiple of their sales because there were no earnings for a lot of the companies in that dot-com bubble. This time, you know, we do have some stretch valuations maybe, but we do have some earnings and the big four do account for 20%. But, you know, we still have the normal dynamics of a trend taking shape where, you know, you're going to ebb and flow, you're going to zigzag and you're going to have pullbacks and upswings, and you're going to get higher highs and higher lows. And so if you look at a long-term chart of XLK, you've got a higher low coming in from October, November 2018 into the spring of 2020, which would be March, and now we have a higher high. So if we mean revert back to, say, the rising 40-week moving average, you could get back to 95. And that might be a 12% pullback in technology, which would actually be fairly normal and even healthy. But technology, QQQ, I think they've gotten really ahead of themselves. And I think the prudent thing to do would be to wait for it to come to you and wait for a pullback to a support zone and a test.
So anything outside of technology look promising to you?
I still like healthcare. And even when you go within healthcare, I still like it. Even though healthcare's had a run, it did have a rest. If you look at the XLV, the healthcare SBDR, it had the big surge in the second half of March and into early April for 4 weeks. And then it moved sideways for several weeks, for almost 3 months. And now it's just now breaking out. So I think healthcare has had its rest, whereas technology did not get its rest yet. So healthcare had the surge, the rest, and now it is breaking out. It broke out to a new high 3 weeks ago, and it's kind of consolidating above that breakout. But I still like healthcare, and within healthcare, medical devices, maybe it's short-term overextended, but it's also got a breakout 3 weeks ago. And we're also starting to see healthcare providers come along with a breakout over the last 3 weeks. So within the sector, it still looks pretty good. And of course, there's biotechs. The IBB had a big down week last week, but it was, you know, quite extended after a big run from 95 to like 145. So that's like a 50% advance. So it could digest these gains before it moves higher.
You know, if you just take a look at fundamentally in this kind of economy where you've got much of the economy shut down, technology companies are thriving. Even some of the media companies, you take a look at Netflix. If you're staying at home, not going to a movie theater, well, you're probably on Netflix or you're watching some kind of streaming service. But another fundamental factor that's also doing well with this crisis is, as you just mentioned, healthcare. And it's, you know, if you take a look globally, demographically, we are an aging population, whether you're looking at Europe where you're at, you're looking at the U.S. or even looking at Asia.
Yeah, that's definitely true. There are some secular tailwinds behind healthcare, and I think even shorter term with the COVID crisis, there are some shorter term tailwinds that are going to affect healthcare, because I don't want to start speculating on the virus, but if you've seen what's happening in the winter in Australia, it's not pretty. It's having a second wave during the winter. And so we're in the summer now, but you know, just around the corner, we've got fall and winter. And so I think demand for all kinds of healthcare products could continue brisk, in addition to that secular trend you discussed.
So if we look at this, let's take a look at something else that's doing very well. And for the first time since 2011, we've seen the breakout of gold hitting a new high this week. It's pulling back here as we speak. We've had silver breakout. We've had, you know, everything from the big mining stocks like Newmont or Barrick to GDX, all of that breaking out. What's your take on gold here?
Well, gold was already one of the strongest. If you like to take bonds, gold, and the S&P and put them together on one chart. And I did that in a commentary a couple weeks ago. And I was just looking at 2 years. And if you look at, well, actually, it's a little over 2 years. But if you go back, say, 2 years, 7 months or so, and you're starting around January 2018, well, the S&P 500 has just had this increasing volatility with a dip, a rise, a bigger dip, a bigger rise, the March crash, and now this big rebound. Whereas you look at gold, it was basing in 2018 into 2019 and got a big breakout in June 2019. Consolidated into the end of 2020 and got a breakout in December. And it was hitting new highs in April. And the S&P 500 was not, it was surging off the low, but it wasn't hitting a new high. And the fact that gold was hitting a new high already told you it was a leader in April. And then it took a rest in May and into June. And then we got this huge breakout. The breakout happened actually in the middle of June. And now we're getting the surge. So it's getting a little bit ahead of itself, as you said. It's a little bit overbought, but this is one you want to have on your radar for pullbacks. And you know, it's not surprising with all of the easing that's going on, all of the liquidity that the Fed and the other central banks are putting into the system. Gold is like the only currency worth its weight these days.
You know, and let's talk about another sector, and that is interest rates. As we take a look at the U.S. bond market, we're seeing yields are not only just in treasuries this time around compared to, let's say, the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, but we're also seeing it at the corporate level. I mean, we were buying bonds in February and March as bond spreads blew out as the economy went into a recession, which is what you would expect. But then the Fed announces it's going to go into the corporate bond market, and you've got yields now that are basically next to nothing. And I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with negative rates before this is all done. So where else are you going to put your money?
Well, it's kind of the TINA, isn't it? There is no alternative that the Fed is putting to work here because you need to get your yield somewhere. And stocks seem to be the answer from the Fed. But it's amazing what's happened with the yield spread. As you said, they blew out in March, and now the AAA spreads are back below the pre-crisis highs, the highs that they hit in January 2019. They're below those highs. The BBB are also below the highs from 2019, so they've come all the way back down. So the Fed has prevented a financial catastrophe by putting this liquidity into the bond market, and that is fine. But then you go look at Treasury yields, and they're still falling. And that is really kind of the big puzzle. You say, okay, do we have a bull market in stocks when Treasury yields are continuing to fall and the 10-year is below? Well, you know, it's around 0.5% almost. It's 0.58%. And the 30-year, I think, is going to break below 1%. So the decline in that downtrend in Treasury yields kind of waves a yellow flag for me.
You know, the surprising thing about all this, and as we talk about this TINA market, there is no alternative. I mean, think of if you're an insurance company where you buy bonds, think of a pension company that has to, or a pension like CalPERS that has to earn a certain rate of return to deliver benefits to its retirees. Or if you are a retired person living on income, you're getting zero at the bank. You're getting zero in money market funds, as we just talked about, 0.1% on Treasury bills, almost 0.5% on 10-year Treasuries. And it looks like the 30-year is going 1% or going below 1%. I mean, where do you go? I guess TINA in this kind of market, but once again, you are taking probably risks that you've never had to take before.
Yeah, that's what it means. You're going to have to take some risk. I mean, if you want yield in the bond market, you're going to have to go to junk. The junk bonds are yielding the most, but of course, that is for a reason. But as I said before, I think healthcare does offer a little bit of stability. And I don't know offhand the yield for the healthcare SBDR, but I would think it would be above the 10-year Treasury yield, definitely, if not above the 30-year Treasury yield. So something like the healthcare SBDR might be an alternative. The thing about the consumer staples SBDR is, yeah, it's defensive, but Procter & Gamble is 16.6% of the ETF. So, you know, it's a big bet on Procter & Gamble. So you got to be careful there. The XLRE is another place you might find yield. And what I like about XLRE is, you know, it's just not your normal REIT like Simon Property with a bunch of malls and what have you. Two of the three biggest holdings are Crown Castle and American Tower. And those two count for 25% of the ETF. And they're, of course, tower stocks. And that's a play on 5G. So you do have a little bit of diversification in XLRE, but unfortunately, you still have exposure to other REITs. And I have a feeling with this COVID, and it's just accelerated some trends that are already in place, like working from home. And so maybe the demand for commercial real estate will never get back to where it was before and maybe start to even decline further.
Yeah, that's the one thing I worry about a lot of these REITs is the commercial exposure. The commercial exposure in shopping malls is a lot of these malls are going under with the acceleration of online shopping, but also commercial real estate like office space. One of the things that we are finding in this downturn, there's about 30-40% of the economy that can work from home. I think Google just announced that their employees are going to be working from home till summer of 2021.
Yeah, companies are seriously rethinking, well, how many people do we really need in the office? Because we can conduct our meetings, you know, via Zoom or what have you, Microsoft Teams, and people were forced into it, and now they've gotten over the hump. And now they know how it works, you know, they come in, it's the norm now. And here in Belgium, we've moved back to teleworking because we're kind of going into lockdown 2.0 because we're starting to see our numbers move up like they did in the second half of March. And so we're trying to get ahead of that by having no more working in the office unless you really have to. And working from home is the norm now.
So when you see like the day we're doing this interview where the U.S. economy contracted by 33%, which is even greater, we've done worse in 3 months than 3 years in the Great Depression. So people see these kind of economic numbers. You drive around, you see stores, businesses closing, and then you see the stock market. What do you tell investors? I mean, with this liquidity in no yield in any place else, it's almost like a tale of two cities. You have one, the economy, which is on a different trajectory, and then you have the market, which is going in an opposite direction. So what do you do as an investor?
Well, I think as an investor, it's, you know, it's hard to be a quote unquote investor, because if you look, as I mentioned, those swings that we've seen in the S&P 500 over the last 2.5 years, you know, we're not getting these big extended trends like we did. You know, 2012, 13, and 14, we had a 3-year uptrend. In 2016, 17, and into the middle of 2018, you could call it an uptrend with a big hiccup in the beginning. But since the summer of 2018, at the very latest, maybe a little earlier, we just had these big swings in the stock market. And that's made this kind of 3+ month time frame really important. And so, to be honest, I am focused exclusively on this swing that started in late March. You've got this big upswing, and as long as that upswing holds, we're in an uptrend in the S&P. And if you look at small caps, they consolidated into July and broke out in mid-July. So they're participating, the equal weight S&P 500 is participating in this breakout. So I have to follow the path of least resistance. And right now it is up, but I'm watching the June lows across the board. And if we start to see these broad indexes break the June lows, then we have problems, especially as we head into August. If that happens in August, because August, September are traditionally seasonally weak months, so then I would be very concerned. But right now, I do think the path of least resistance is up.
And Art, a final question. I've always asked this of technicians. What is it about September and October tend to be stormy months of the year for, it's like the Grand Banks off the Atlantic coast during the winter months. What is it about September, October?
It's hard to put a finger on what, maybe August is just the dog days of summer. And people just want to be at the beach, you know, before September hits and school gets underway. I'm not sure. But I've done back tests and looked at the seasonal periods. And it's really a 4-month window with July in the middle. That July's okay, but it's June, it's August, and it's September that are the three weakest months. October is a volatile month, but it tends to be a bullish month. And then November and December are by far and away very strong months outside of April. So November, December, April are the three strongest months. But for whatever reason, the historical data says that August and September are by far the weakest months for the U.S. stock market. And then October, sometimes you get a bottom in the middle of October. So it does have a positive bias.
All right. Well, listen, Art, your website as we close?
So my website is trendinvestorpro.com. And I offer broad market timing strategies and models. And they're geared towards trend and momentum. And I have an ETF ranking and grouping report that I put out every Thursday. And I've got a nice video on Saturday that wraps everything up and shows you what we're looking out for in the coming weeks.
All right. Well, listen, Art, stay safe and take care of yourself, and look forward to talking to you once again.
All right, Jim, you too. I'll talk to you again.
For many years, we've discussed on our show the increasing role that AI and machine learning have played and will continue to play in the financial markets. Over the past decade or more, the use of AI was mostly confined to hedge funds or large investment institutions that were able to pay top dollar for unleashing cutting-edge computational techniques on the market. Today, however, that is no longer the case, as more companies are now making AI available to a larger set of investors. One of those companies is called Boosted.ai. We are joined today by their COO, Nick Abbey. So Nick, let's start things off talking about how large of a role AI and machine learning are playing in the stock market and the financial markets today.
I think overall, what you're seeing today is what you described, where the top players in the industry are spending an absolute ton of money on it and then using it very actively. But it's very much still the early days in the Wild West. And now, I think for the 2020s, that's why we're going to see machine learning being increasingly important. The concept behind our firm is pretty simple. This whole platform is a multi-stage process. We can kind of boil it down to two steps. One is security selection, taking the securities in your universe and effectively saying, these are the ones to buy, these are the ones to sell. And then step two is portfolio construction, which is, given that I've made those security selections, how do I turn that into a portfolio that makes sense for what I'm doing? And, you know, what knobs and levers are there around that? And obviously, there's a ridiculous amount. Maybe you want to be neutral to the sector weightings of the S&P 500, plus or minus 2%. Maybe you only want to have 20 stocks in your portfolio. Maybe you want to have 100. Maybe you want to optimize for sharp. Maybe you want to optimize to reduce your vol. Maybe you want to have a certain dividend yield, et cetera, et cetera. And so just having all those tools surfaceable to the user in a way that they don't need to know programming. They just need to know what end output they want.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, the deficit is going up, but it's been going up for several decades now. Will it become an issue as we face growing entitlements in the remainder of this decade? Joining me on the program is Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's professor of economics at Boston University, and he's also a New York Times bestselling author. You know, Professor, you have written extensively about growing entitlements, how to fix them, from Social Security to Medicare. I'd like to put those in perspective now with our deficits. I think the deficit this year is going to be somewhere close to $3 trillion by the time we get to September, maybe more. You probably have better figures than I do. And they're talking about another multi-trillion dollar stimulus program. So where does this lead us as we head into this decade when we're beginning with such an incredible amount of debt currently?
We have an enormous amount of on-the-book debt, but then we have a huge amount of vastly larger amount of off-the-book liabilities for paying off Social Security obligations, Medicare, Medicaid obligations, funding the Defense Department, just paying for the president's lunch and all the other government expenses. And though that whole path of outlays, including servicing the official debt, far and away exceeds the entire projected path of receipt. So we're spending far too much relative to what we're taking in now and projecting to take in the form of taxes. And this potentially greatest depression that we're experiencing right now is just making things far worse. But we were in terrible shape to begin with. This is the picture of a declining country. And now we've got ourselves cut off from the rest of the world because of our ineffective handling of the crisis. And the rest of the world, which is, you know, economically doing much better and health-wise doing much better, is going to start interacting without the U.S. And so you're seeing a decline, I believe, in certain markets in the dollar, and that may continue, and that may have implications for inflation and putting us into a deeper hole.
Yeah, the thing that really strikes me about this pandemic, and certainly I don't think any of us have seen it, at least I haven't seen it in my lifetime, where you shut down a vast swath of the economy and then substitute debt in money printing. I don't know what it's like where you live, Professor, but all around me, I am seeing businesses left and right that are going under. Where the business is going under, that means the government is getting less tax revenue. People are being laid off. That means more people on unemployment. That means also less tax revenue for the federal government and state government. I don't know how you can run an economy where you shut down a large portion of it and expect to replace it with money printing and debt.
Right. About half of the workforce, perhaps at most, can work remotely. The other half have to be working physically. And that part is largely shut down, as you said. Now, if you think about, well, can the economy do okay with half of the people out of work? Well, no. In the Great Depression, at its peak, we had about 25% of the workforce unemployed. Here we're talking about maybe, you know, 50% ultimately when these companies fully give it up. And that's coming because if one company lays off people, then for a while they may be able to maintain their spending. But after some point, after they're evicted, they're not going to be buying anything at all, basically, from anybody. They're going to postpone all kinds of expenditure. And then that's going to affect other businesses that were still in operation, and they're going to fail. So this is just as a cumulative impact that's very negative. So you want to stop these recession, these problems right at the get-go. The government's been trying to do that by keeping companies alive, but it hasn't done anything to fundamentally stop the virus. And that's the key thing. You can't print your way out of this problem. You have to basically contain and kill the virus. And the way to do that, I've written about this at my website, kotlikoff.net. If your listeners want to go and take a look, they'll find six articles, including one recently. Some co-authored and some not, but there was a recent one with Michael Mina, who's a top epidemiologist at Harvard, that appeared in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago, talking about how we could have a Manhattan Project and within a couple of months have at-home rapid tests, like a pregnancy-type test, that everybody could take every day, and the ones who are positive would stay home for a couple of weeks or go to the hospital if they get really sick. Everybody else outside would be sending a picture of their negative test to their employer, to the restaurant, to the school, and going about their regular business. So we would have the whole thing over within a month. I mean, absolutely over. This is feasible. There's another feasible methodology, which is called group testing, which I wrote five columns about, including one with my brother, who's the Cornell provost. This is a 70-year-old technology of pooling tests. People have probably heard about this of late because we were able with the people in the White House to get the FDA to change their language to allow group testing. And if a national federal policy was put together, we could have every household group tested every week and bring this whole thing to a conclusion as well within a month. So there are ways to do this if you have leadership at the top. And we're not going to get out of this hole until we fix the virus.
So what about the possibilities that they're talking about a vaccine or some kind of drug to combat it?
Well, that's fantastic. And that may all appear by December. It sounds like there's maybe two or three different ones in large scale with stage three testing. And so that's a great hope. But we should be trying, we've had vaccines come and go that haven't been effective. It took a long time to get an HIV. We don't have an HIV vaccine at this point. Even though people have been trying for years, they do have ways to reduce the potentiality for infection if people do get infected, to keep the symptoms at a level. But as far as I know, there's no vaccine. Maybe I'm wrong on that. So I'm hopeful the vaccine will come along. If that does, that'd be great. But in the process, we will have destroyed so many businesses, as you're referencing. If you go to Boston, where I'm at, you have a ghost town. We've actually moved to Providence. I'll be commuting to Boston University because we needed to have one more space. But Providence is also a ghost town. I don't know if the kids are going to come back, students. So around the country, you have this situation that things are not back to normal. And then in the South, where things have opened up, and the West, it's become a situation where things have to close down again. So this does not bode well for, even if we had a vaccine today, it would take a while to vaccinate everybody. And at the end of, 6 months, maybe we get everybody vaccinated, maybe it's safe again, but we have an economy in shambles. It took years for the economy to recover from the Great Recession when we had 4% output decline. We're going to have a 40% output decline in the second quarter, is my guesstimate. Once the numbers are reported, maybe it'll be 30%, but it's going to be vastly larger than what happened at the peak of the Great Recession. And it took many years to recover from that. So we should not be kidding ourselves about a fast recovery here.
Yeah, there's been various proposals, a V-shaped recovery, a U-shaped recovery, a W-shaped recovery. I just don't see a V as the market is anticipating, Professor. You can't destroy the amount of businesses that we're destroying. And, you know, these poor people, and no fault of their own, when the government says you can't open your doors, I don't care if you're a hair salon, a gym, or a restaurant, a lot of these businesses aren't going to come back. And so this unemployment rate that we're at right now, we could be with this for quite some time.
Yeah, the economic term for the problem here is called coordination failure. Suppose that you're a small business and I'm a small business and we've both been put out of business. Maybe we have enough money to get to start up again at maybe at a lower level, but at least now let's suppose that I'm hiring your employees and I was hiring your employees and you're hiring my employees and we're now both out of business. And I'm thinking to myself, gee, should I set up again? I'm not sure the gym is going to reopen. And if Jim doesn't reopen, I'm not going to get his customer. I'm not going to get customers from Jim. His employees, he won't be paying his workers, and therefore they won't come shop at my shop and or my restaurant or whatever, and or buy my service. Maybe it's whatever it is. And the same thing with Jim. Jim, you're going to think the same thing about, am I going to be rehiring? So everybody is kind of waiting for everybody else to do something so that it's profitable for them to get back in the business. And then you have just a bad equilibrium, a bad outcome, a coordination failure, as we economists refer to it. And that can last for years. And if you think about what happened in the Great Depression, things were very bad for 10 years until somebody came on the scene, which was the Defense Department, and made it clear to everybody that there was going to be real demand for goods and services, that there were customers coming because the government was going to be hiring everybody and those people were going to get paid and be able to buy things from other people. That's the problem. That's a coordination failure, a problem that can lead to long-term stagnation.
I want to talk about a solution that's being proposed. In fact, there's a book out there by Stephanie Kelton called The Deficit Myth. And according to modern monetary theory, the way you handle this problem, if you are a country like the U.S. that issues its debt in its own currency, you just simply take on more debt and you just simply print money.
Well, what Stephanie is suggesting, I debated her about a month ago with all the other heads of the modern monetary theory. I got to say, these people are supposed to be trained economists, but they don't sound like trained economists. They don't, from one sentence to the next, they're not providing a coherent, logical argument. It's a lot of sloganism and failure to recognize and focus on the mechanics of monetary policy, which are no surprise to anybody who knows about monetary policy, and they're not telling us anything deep about what's going on. So if Stephanie's idea here is that the U.S., because we have the reserve currency, can just print money out the wazoo and pay for everything, then let's run her experiment, which is let's cut all taxes to zero for the indefinite future and just print money and see how long that works. And that's not even working today as we speak. Probably the dollar is, there has been some depreciation of the dollar vis-a-vis some different currencies in the last week or so. But if the U.S. announced that policy, you can expect the dollar to depreciate dramatically. Import prices will go up to the extent we're still importing, and that would kick off inflation, and people in the U.S. would start moving away from the dollar as well. And then the dollar becomes, interest rates would rise. The deficit would automatically get bigger because we'd have to start paying high interest rates on government. The government would have to pay higher interest rates on its bonds. And the whole thing would, turn into a god-awful mess. And by the time we got out of this, we would have high inflation. So Stephanie thinks that, we could cut taxes dramatically. And if and when inflation takes off, we would then cut back on the policy, or we'd have price controls. Price controls have been tried and failed many, many times. Go back to the Nixon price controls on gasoline. There were not Nixon, Carter. They're just a horrendous mistake. The And you know, Soviet Union type price controls also didn't work for their countries. So and so the so this is not really a mature adult's answer to countries that are healthy don't leave their bills for their kids. They don't try and secretly tax households on their money balances by running policies that produce inflation, and that waters down people's holdings of government bonds that are paying off in nominal terms. They're paying off just in dollars. It waters down the money that you have in your checking account. It's about two thirds of our government debt are held by foreigners. So are they going to want to be watered down when the dollar starts depreciating and they get payback in, you know, in fewer Canadian dollars or UK pounds or European euros, euros? No, they're going to. That's going to lead them to move further away from the dollar. And so this is not an answer. You don't, if you have a strong economy and it gets to the good position of being a reserve currency, you don't expropriate, you don't exploit that position. You don't take advantage of it. And you just enjoy it through time, that position. The fact that you're able to print money and the rest of the world's willing to take your pieces of paper in exchange for real goods and services, because you have the advantage of having a reserve currency and people are using it. So you can get some real revenues from that through time. But if you try and go overboard on this, it will boomerang. And that's what she's proposing. So I don't view her as a serious economist. I view her as, you know, basically a kook on the left, just like we've seen supply side fanatics on the right. This is economic extremism, and it's been tried in the past and hasn't worked. All I have to do is look at Venezuela today, or look at hyperinflations in Hungary after World War II, or Germany and the Weimar Republic. There's plenty of history where countries that have been irresponsible, fiscally speaking, have gotten into huge trouble by printing their way out of it. And it seems like she has no historical sense.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can take an old idea that has failed like this, print money, and somehow get prosperity. It's been repackaged, reformulated, but she's getting a lot of adherence in the party. Isn't that a risk at a time we're shutting down a good portion of the economy, and in its place we're substituting debt, and with this idea, well, we just simply print money?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of kind of magical thinking out there. And Social Security has a $53 trillion unfunded liability, according to its trustees report from April.
Wow.
Which is much bigger now, you know, as a result of what's been happening. I'm sure the next report will make it be closer to $70 trillion. So, yeah, this is highly irresponsible. But, you know, people are selfish fundamentally. And unless you have government leaders who say, you know what, we have a responsibility to our kids, not just to your kids, but the other kids. The other kids are going to help your kids, not have to, you know, pay their taxes. So we have to make sure that nobody, that our country's not drowning in debt, so that our kids get up and leave collectively, and the country falls apart. Which, look at Venezuela. People have left, right, and center. Look at Uruguay in the 70s when the tax rates got sky high. 500,000 people from the small country got up, young people, and took off, mostly to Spain. So do we want this to happen in our country? Do we want to run our country like Argentina ran itself for the last century and went from a developing country in 1910? It was a developed country. It's the fifth highest per capita GDP country. They spent a century running deficits off the books, on the books, and then they had hyperinflation periodically, international debt defaults. And the president, our president, has been talking about defaulting on U.S. official debt because that's what he ran his business doing, basically screwing his business partners over by defaulting on what he was obligated to pay them and going bankrupt left, right, and center. That's not the way we run the United States of America, if it's the United States of America that I was born into.
Well, it's an issue that has come up on both sides, and you know, it's not just a one-party thing. The Democrats are embracing it. You have a lot of Republicans that are embracing it, and it seems to be surfacing as a possible solution. As you look forward and you take a look at where we are today, but let's just assume by January, you've got companies like Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, one other company that are supposed to have these vaccines, and maybe they'll have a drug that cures the issue. The problem that I see here, Professor, you've got restaurants, gyms, all kinds of business, retail establishments. I mean, I can walk into a Costco and a Walmart, but the shopping centers are closed. So how do you revitalize that and recoup with, I see this unemployment issue in business and weak economy lasting for multi-years. You just can't destroy a business and expect, you're going to write them a check or they're going to be in shape to restart again.
No, it's confidence. Business confidence will be down the tubes because there's going to be so many people unemployed. People will be in so much shock. People that went through the depression took on a depression mentality because they saw, we're not at the point where people are starving in the streets. I mean, some are, but very few. But as foreclosures start happening, people are just, going to be very worried. The personal saving rate is way up. People aren't spending, and they're not likely to start spending once we get a vaccine. They're likely to be terrified from what happened and in shock. And as I said, they're hooking up these unemployed people with new companies they're willing to hire. It's going to be a very difficult, long process because you've taken Humpty Dumpty and he's fallen in many, many pieces. And now putting him back together is going to be very difficult. So absolutely, this is, this is the, if we had everybody cured, if the virus was dead today, if it was completely captured and killed today, and it could have been had the president acted in time months ago, and I view him as having lost this war and still losing it and having ended up killing lots and lots of Americans, because I was writing about this, you can go to my website, the end of March, there are articles after articles saying, here's how to fix this, and protocols for we could definitely be out of the woods right now without the mask, without the social distancing, just by testing in an efficient way with technology that we had then. So you're absolutely right, Jim, that this is just going to be a long-term problem that it's just not going to turn around, even if things were fine health-wise today, because of the dislocation.
The thing that really concerns me is we have an aging baby boomer population. As you just mentioned, the Social Security trustees just announced that we've got $53 trillion of unfunded liabilities. That's about 13 and a half years of government tax revenues. That's how big that is. You throw that into the equation mid-decade, plus the destruction probably 25% of our U.S. economy or more. Professor, I was interviewing the head of the hotel association. They think about 40% of the hotels will go under. 30% of the restaurants are going to go under. About 70-80% of the gyms are going to go under. And probably half of the retail establishments are going to go under. I mean, that's a large swath of the U.S. economy to replace.
And the stock market also seems to think this is going to be okay. It's the people that are investing who kept the stock market up in the last few months somehow don't get this. Other people have now, a lot of people are saying, well, it's the Federal Reserve pumping so much money into the economy. Unless they start buying up the stock market, I don't see how we prevent the stock market from collapsing at least 50% from where it is now. Because as you said, we have all these companies out. The companies that needed loans to get by have presumably gotten those loans at the very low interest rates or zero interest rates. But there are a lot of companies who are not going to borrow because they can't ever repay the principal. They don't want to go into debt just to go bankrupt in a couple of years. I mean, maybe they do. Maybe they say, well, okay, if the Fed just wants to keeps lending us money, in effect, through the banking system, and we can keep borrowing at 0% and just borrow to repay the borrowing, we'll just keep doing that and postpone our bankruptcy for 10 years and we'll just pay ourselves. That's producing lots of zombie firms that really cannot ever be viable. And we have probably at least, I've heard an estimate of 20% of the firms in the U.S. are zombie firms that can never recover and that are just living off of borrowed money. So that's not exactly a solid economic policy. That's just taking from Peter to give to, robbing Peter to give to Paul. And Peter is our children because the bills are going to be left to our kids.
You know, you mentioned something that if we continue along this road, that we could possibly see a severe correction or bear market in stocks, given the reality of the economy. But what about the Fed printing money? You said, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, Professor, if the next thing they do is they buy stocks. I mean, this time around, they're buying corporate bonds. They're buying junk bonds. They're buying ETFs. In the Great Recession, they bought mortgages and they bought government debt. This time, they're buying government debt. They're buying mortgages. They're buying corporate bonds. They're buying junk bonds. They're buying ETFs. I mean, you know, typically when you go into a recession as we're in now, credit spreads start to widen, which is what happened in February and March because we were in the bond market buying. But then the Fed announced that they were jumping in and they were going to buy corporate bonds. Now you have bond rates for corporate bonds at such low levels, there isn't any compensation to investors for the risk they're taking. So why not buy stocks next?
Yeah, so they may buy, you know, they're buying securities of these companies. So think about the Fed. The Fed is saying to the public and probably to Stephanie Kelton and her brain that, gee, we're not actually engaged in printing money. All we're doing is we're buying securities, we're buying assets. And when the time comes, we'll just sell these bonds of the different companies back to the market, or these companies will just pay us back. But what if they're buying bonds of companies that are about to fail or will fail? They'll never be able to pay back. So they've just given money to company XYZ for a promise to get the money back. So but the money never comes back. So the money, just think about it in physical terms, there's more money out there, more dollars, if you like, circulating. And now we have... So that's the basis for inflation in the end. And inflation is kind of a hidden tax. It leads to our federal income tax is a pretty well inflation index, except the Social Security part. So you get some more revenues there, but not a whole lot. The state income taxes aren't inflation index, so they'll be bracket creep to the extent that those are progressive tax rates. But there's not a lot of, you know, money to be made, real revenue to be made by through the tax system by printing more, by having inflation. So the only way you really get resources is you just print money and buy stuff, and that means that inflation takes off even more rapidly. People are facing a tax right now on the inflation that's occurring right now. You might say, well, there's no inflation right now. And Stephanie Kelton would say, well, that's ridiculous. There's no inflation right now. But there is an inflation right now. It's relative to what would have been the case had the Fed not intervened in this, this historically unprecedented manner. Right now, we would be seeing deflation and people holding nominal liabilities of the government, just money in their checking accounts, for example, or cash in their pocket. With lower prices, they would be experiencing a capital gain. Because the government has printed so much money, we haven't seen a deflation. We've seen, compared to that, we've seen inflation. And therefore, we've in effect taxed these people who would otherwise be experiencing a transfer payment, in effect, a gain on their existing money balances. Now, this is a subtle argument, but it's trying to point out that the modern monetary theorists think that inflation is costless. It's not costless even at this moment. And it's not that we're not actually running inflation. It's running, you have to think about inflation relative, the price level, relative to what it would otherwise have been without the policy. So inflation has got to be in the context of what policy you're running. And then you have to say, well, if you weren't running that policy, what would things be? What would the price level be? And what I'm pointing out is the price level would have been a lot lower today than it is and all of us who have money balances would be better off. And we're not better off, so we've been taxed. So even right now, the government's generating real seniorage, real revenues from us through what they're doing. So it hasn't been like some magical freebie that nobody's been experiencing. I said this in this debate with Stephanie and other proponents of the modern monetary theory, no reaction whatsoever. I'm not sure that they got the point. It's a subtle point, but it's one that they're missing big time.
How long do you think it is before inflation would start to show up? I mean, we're seeing it if you want to look at some of the prices of these stocks, and I'm talking about a lot of these tech stocks that are approaching multi-trillion dollar market caps. So we're definitely seeing it in certain asset prices this week. Gold just hit a new record. In fact, it hit another new record on the day you and I are doing this interview. So we're starting to see precious metals kind of forewarn us what may lie ahead. Do you see perhaps in the short run is what we get is stagflation, where we get anemic, basically negative economic growth with higher prices?
So not all the movements in asset prices are due to the Fed, you know, directly. You know, if the Fed buys up the bonds of a company that's and hands them a, you know, lets them pay a zero rate of return interest rate rather than 8% on their junk bonds, that's going to be a benefit to the shareholders of that company, and the stock price will go up as a result. But when we're talking about gold, that's not something that where the Fed's, you know, directly intervening in the gold market, at least not yet. So that's a reaction to the fear of what's really going on in the economy that we've been talking about. And that's just an indication, you know, that we're moving away from the, people are moving from the dollar into gold. They're moving from the dollar into silver. They're moving from the dollar into probably Canadian dollar today. I haven't looked at the markets today, but they're moving into the Europe of late has appreciated from what I understand. So, and also the Chinese currency, the yuan, will presumably be appreciating. This is what you expect to see when you have the economic leader acting irresponsibly and having kind of self-inflicted economic wounds here that are major and long-term. You'd expect things to move in this direction. I mean, think of the UK when it went from having the world's reserve currency, the pound, to becoming like a second-rate power when it lost all its colonies. Things happened pretty quickly. Before World War II, it was... go back to the beginning of before World War I, it was a dominant world economy. At the end of World War II, the pound is no longer the reserve currency, it's the dollar, and the UK is like a third-rate international economic power. And in the history of the world, that's a very short period of time that transformation occurred. That can happen in the U.S. The U.S., long-term, is going to shrink demographically because world population is going to be adding 2.5 population growth is going to be adding 2.5 China's between now and the end of the century, according to the UN projections. Now, COVID might change the population replication, but if things go as were projected a year ago, then we're talking about 2.5 more China's, mostly situated in the Middle East, India, and Africa, primarily. Africa is a really big place for population growth. And if those countries catch up technologically speaking to the U.S., if their real wages start looking like the U.S. real wages, the U.S. is going to end up with 5% of world GDP at the end of the century. Well, then we're talking about the U.S. being to the world like Germany is to the world today. And that's the future of economic power right there. So independent of any policy in the U.S., independent of our debts, independent of COVID, just the demographics interacting with productivity growth, catch-up growth in these different regions can spell the end of the U.S. Hegemony, world economic hegemony, just by itself. And then you've got, you know, what's going on specifically in the U.S. that's accelerating that process. So that's the broader context. That, you know, I'm sure that most people in the world do not know that we're in the process of adding 2.5 China's in terms of the world population in the next 80 years.
So, Professor, as we go forward and we continue these policies, as we've been talking about here, destroying almost 25% of the U.S. economy, if not more, and we substitute debt and printing, do you see, if we continue and do not make a course correction here, and especially with these unfunded liabilities that you're talking about on Social Security, we haven't talked about Medicare, could you see the dollar losing its currency status? And we could go the same way that Great Britain did, and on a worst-case basis, the way of Argentina. I mean, just look what's going on in Venezuela and still Argentina today.
Yeah, you know, there are lots of question marks here. What currency would take over? Would people really want to operate in the yuan, the Chinese currency? It could be that China starts coercing countries to make and companies to make deals that pay in their currency, you know, that are denominated in their currency. That's really the key to the country, a currency becoming a reserve currency where the contracts are being denominated, being written in those currencies. You have to pay so much yuan for the delivery of these goods or for the purchase of these goods. And when that could happen just naturally, or it could be through some Chinese government coercion. If you think about what other currency could take over, well, I don't think it's going to be the Swiss franc, because I don't think that people would view Switzerland as strong enough a country militarily and physically to big enough to be have the world's reserve currency. And then you got the pound, and the UK's got very similar problems to the US. And then you got the Eurozone, which might break apart. So it could be that we move to a world where we have a lot of, we don't have a single reserve currency, where we just have a lot of currencies, including Bitcoin, that are kind of competing with each other. And people are writing contracts in all these different currencies, and there's nothing, and that's highly inefficient. In terms of, you know, if you kind of think back to before the Eurozone was created, you could take a round trip through the countries of the Eurozone and be, you know, just the transactions cost of swapping your money by the end of the trip, having never actually bought anything, you might be left with 50 cents on the dollar, having paid all the cost of just going from one country to the other and exchanging money. So I don't know. What would be the world dominating, you know, the world reserve currency to take over from the U.S.? But I do know that at some point people will have had their fill with the U.S. policy and with U.S. U.S. dollars. And maybe this is, you know, the path could also be we have high inflation for a while, and then another government takes over, another administration comes in and starts running sensible policy in the U.S., and things get back to normal. But that process of running high inflation for a bit, maybe for a decade, until people realize we need to have a responsible government, and that process will wipe out a lot of people's holdings of certain types of securities that are dollar denominated, and we need to be on the, you know, kind of personally on the lookout for that. If you think about what happened in the 70s, we ran pretty high inflation under Nixon. Was irresponsible fiscally, and Arthur Burns at the Federal Reserve Bank printing money to help Nixon win the war, it seemed. And then you had Carter engaging in some crazy policies and loss of confidence. And we had, and then Volcker comes along and scares the market. And we have, in this context, 10% inflation for many years, going maybe three or so years. And then we get some more sensible, well, I don't know whether it's more sensible policy. Reagan takes over and somehow calms everybody's nerves and then starts running deficits of his own. So a country can have, you know, somebody can have a slowly growing cancer for a long time. And if periodically it's operated on, it can delay final death. But in the end, it's going to go after the organs and then it'll be too late. That's kind of what I see Argentina's history, economic history, as it takes a long period of time to run a country into the tubes, to go from fifth per capita GDP to being one of the poor countries in the world in terms of economic per capita GDP. And that's what the U.S. is engaged in, a long post-war process of running the country down.
Sounds like, Professor, a long decade of turbulence. Winston Churchill once said about America, they'll try everything wrong before they eventually get it right. So maybe that's what we're going to have to do before we get it right. Professor, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you have a website. Would you give that out, please?
Yeah, there's a couple of websites I would suggest people take a look at. So I do a lot of work on different issues in economics. We talked a lot about macroeconomics and work on economic growth and carbon taxation and climate change and banking reform and healthcare reform. So because I'm old enough to have worked on a lot of these issues, it's not that I'm that productive. It's just that I'm old, if you like. And so there's papers and books and articles, columns. I read a lot of columns for different outlets, also about testing for COVID. So kotlikoff.net, you'll see books, columns, and articles. Just peruse there. But also, I do a lot of work on personal finance. And of immediate use to people would be some of the article, the columns on personal finance that are posted at kotlikoff.net. But also, I have on the side a software company. We have a tool called Maxify.com, M-A-X-I-F-I.com. It's, the program is actually called Maxify Planner. It will help people figure out a personal financial future that's will help them improve their financial future to the extent possible. You know, if they've lost their job, they might want to use the tool to think about retiring later, or downsizing their home, or prepaying their mortgage by taking money out of their 401k and paying off their mortgage, because the 401k, after risk is adjusted for, is paying nothing right now. So this might be the perfect time to pay off your mortgage that you're stuck with a 3.5% interest rate on. If you want to get a real return, pay off your debts, pay off your mortgage debt, pay off your car loan, pay off your credit card bills. And the taking money or reducing your contributions to retirement accounts, or taking your retirement account money and using that, even if you have to pay taxes, you'll be able to see with this program whether it's worth it in terms of will it save you taxes. And that translates back into higher lifetime discretionary spending. And that's the bottom line of the program's after, which is how can we maximize your lifetime discretionary spending?
All right. And that website is Kotlikoff. That is KOTLIKOFF.net. Professor, it was a pleasure having you on the program. Hopefully down the road, we can figure this out and get it right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, Jim, for months and months, we've been speaking on our show about how this period of time is going to be likened to the Great Depression, talking about a mini depression, hopefully not a full-fledged depression. But this week, we did get a very important number out showing just how severe the situation is. So let's talk about how this fits, what we saw this week, in the context of one of the themes that we've been talking about now for many months is recession or depression, and how important government policy is going to play in just how much further the pendulum swings into the depression category versus hopefully back into recovery and eventual growth.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me about the economic numbers, we had been hearing from Wall Street that probably a 15 to 20% contraction in the second quarter. Chris, the numbers seasonally at an annual rate was 33%. Now, let me explain that number. It doesn't mean the economy dropped 33%. It means if it was to continue and you annualize it, it would be down 33%. In actual numbers, the economy is down almost 10% year over year. What really stands out here, this is probably the steepest decline that we've seen in 70 years. And as they reported, 17 million people are on unemployment benefits. You've seen consumer confidence, plunge, and that's a key figure. Because if you're going to give money, which is what the government's trying to do, in order, since they've blown such a huge hole in the economy, to replace it, they're going to give you checks. They're going to give you money. That's what they're working on right now. But if you don't have the confidence to go out and spend that money, you probably aren't going to spend that money. And that's what happened. Consumer confidence plunged from 98 to 92. And so, you know, Chris, this is so unique in so many ways. We've never seen an economy contract deliberately as a result of what government is doing with policy.
Yeah, Jim, I remember when I would be speaking with some of my friends and colleagues about this around March, April timeframe, saying that what we're seeing is just absolutely unprecedented, and talking about some of the things that we've been telling our listeners, that we're going to be looking at a mini depression here. And it took a lot of people by surprise that comparison was even valid. But when you think about it, I mean, given, like you said, 32.9% contraction for the second quarter, that's down on a year-over-year basis by 9.5%. That is the biggest contraction we have ever seen on record. And now we're seeing that these numbers, the 32.9%, was even well above what was being predicted as a worst-case scenario early on.
Yeah, in fact, just as a comparison to the Great Depression, from 1929 to the end of 1933, the economy fell and contracted by 50%. Now, let me explain some of the numbers. In 1929, GDP was $105 billion. In today's dollars, that'd be somewhere around a trillion. By 1933, GDP fell to $56 billion. However, CPI fell by 27%. So prices plunged by over 25%. So part of the decline in GDP. But we never saw numbers like what we saw reported yesterday. And let me just give you an example. In 1930, the economy contracted by 8.5%. We just contracted by 9.5% year over year. 1931, the economy contracted 16%. 1932, the economy contracted 23%. So in a three-year period, the economy was down about 50%. And what makes this even more remarkable, remember it took 3 years to get that in the Depression. We did this in 3 months. And that's why I think this is probably one of the worst policy mistakes that we have made. And that's why, Chris, I think that what we're seeing as a result of this, this is accelerating a lot of trends that were in place prior to COVID. And I want to talk about that. We're seeing, and we'll get to this in a minute when we talk about Amazon. Online retail is accelerating, shrinking brick and mortar. You're going to see probably, as we mentioned, half of the retail malls and go out of business. We just simply have too much retail space. And that has important implications if you're investing in real estate investment trusts. I'd be real leery about trusts that are investing in shopping centers or have investments in shopping centers because they're losing their major tenants. And think of those shopping centers being shut down right now, like in California. And then also commercial office space, because we're finding about 30% of the economy can operate remotely. Google said it's going to allow its employees to work from home until summer of 2021. Facebook is doing the same. A lot of these tech companies are doing that. Commercial real estate. And we've seen major companies from Nationwide and other big companies saying, you know what, we don't need as much commercial office space. Travel is going to be more local. Staycations are going to be more local. And we're moving rapidly into this digital economy. And then also, Chris, I think when you see the anarchy in these big American cities from New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Portland, Seattle, all these big blue cities where you absolutely have anarchy. I mean, what is it? The riots have been going on for 60 days in Portland. So this migration wave away from high tax, high cost of living, and then I would say cities where you have absolute chaos and anarchy is going to create and accelerate that migration wave out of these big high tax, overcrowded areas where it's expensive to live, and you're going to see them move to other states, smaller cities, And we've had Kathy Fetke on here talking about this in real estate. So basically, I think this is just going to accelerate a lot of those trends, brings up Joseph Schumpeter's proposition about creative destruction. You're seeing a lot of that today.
And you know what's fascinating about this is this week, just to put this into perspective, at the very same time that we got this massive number of just how bad the U.S. economy was hit in the second quarter, we also got second quarter earnings, and tech stock earnings blew out, right? They were way above what analysts were expecting. So we see the economy going one direction, or at least we did in the second quarter, and we see the tech sector going in a completely different direction. So like you said, the tale of two cities, this dichotomy between what's driving the markets and what's driving the economy, they're two very different environments right now.
You know, you've heard our technicians talk on the program how you have a handful of tech stocks that are driving the S&P and the NASDAQ. I mean, these are this digital economy, and it's not surprising in this kind of atmosphere, these are companies are doing well. Apple reported earnings on Thursday. Their earnings were up 26%. Their earnings came in at 258 versus estimates of 205. Sales were up 13%. You take a look at Amazon. Amazon sales were up 49% year over year. Earnings came in at $10.30 versus estimates of $1.74. I saw, Chris, I mean, Amazon's a little over $3,200. Now I've seen estimates for Amazon stock price at $6,500 a share. I mean, think about it. Their sales are up 49%. What have we been doing during this shutdown? We've been buying stuff online. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is going to accelerate. It kind of reminds me of the Gilded Age when you had major companies, Carnegie Steel, you had J.P. Morgan Bank, Standard Oil, and you know, this is the digital age, and you've got four tech titans out there. They're very similar to those big, massive companies of wealth and power that you saw in the at the end of the 19th century.
These big tech companies are obviously taking advantage or profiting from the COVID environment, like you said. I mean, Amazon, people aren't going out as much to stores. They're buying stuff on Amazon. But it's funny you think about it, because if the economy is going to recover from here, and that's what we're all hoping for, then in that sense, it's kind of not looking so good for some of these overvalued tech stocks. Because what happens as the economy starts opening up and people go to stores? Well, they're going to probably pare back on their Amazon purchases and start buying stuff back at normal stores that they accustomed to shopping at. People aren't going to be probably watching as much Netflix if hopefully they're back at their job or have a job. Same with, you know, Google and Facebook. Like, how much time are you going to be spending on Facebook if you are back at work and hopefully being productive? So there might be a little bit of an inverse correlation between tech stocks and the economy right now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, if we normalize and assume we either get a vaccine or you know, we have drugs out there that can help with COVID. The problem is so much of what is going on handling COVID is political science versus, let's say, medical science. And but as we normalize, and hopefully we do, and whether we normalize, Chris, here's a big question. Whether we normalize or not is going to depend on policy. If we continue to make policy mistakes, then we could be in a long-lasting depression. And that's what one of the things that made the depression as long-lasting as it was the government kept making policy mistakes. And remember, this is all, this contraction is all been government-directed. And the problem is, when you take a look at this, you know, the politicians, I mean, they're not unemployed. They're getting their checks, even though they're working remotely. Their medical benefits haven't changed. So when you have somebody that's grown up in the political system and on a government check, it's hard for them to relate to actual people out there that are trying to make a living, try to feed their family, or trying to run a business. And so it's just easy, oh, we're just going to shut things down. You know, I've talked to numerous people, and luckily I was able to find a place to cut my hair. And, you know, they're doing it sort of in a special way just to stay alive. And that is the case with many businesses. I mean, think of yourself if you're running a business. I don't care if you're a restaurant, running a hair salon, nail salon, whatever it is. All of a sudden, the government comes after, you know, you've been running your business for decades. And they go, you know what? You got to shut down. You can't open up. And, oh, you can file for unemployment. Maybe you'll get PPP. And maybe we'll give you a check. But we're shutting it down. I've seen, well, you've seen this, Chris. You just go to any shopping center and just look at all the empty signs in the window, out of business. And that's the real question is, if we do normalize, what is normal going to look like?
So in terms of policy mistakes, like you mentioned, what are some of the biggest that would tip us back into either more of the depression mode and away from recovery?
You know, the biggest policy mistake is to keep this economy shut down as long as it is, because the more businesses you destroy, the harder it is to make a comeback and have a normal type economy. So that's number one. Number two, you know, when you want to shut the economy down and you just want to give people transfer payments or give people checks, what are you doing? You are cutting down the supply of services and goods, and yet you're giving people money to spend on those supply and goods while you're cutting supply. And the direct result of that is going to be inflationary. So you're printing money, issuing debt to pay for it, and yet you're destroying part of that supply chain or service chain by shutting down businesses. So the end result of this, Chris, is going to be inflation. And according to modern monetary theory, well, you don't really have to worry about that, because if you do, you just raise taxes. Well, that was one of the big mistakes they made in the Great Depression. They raised taxes to 50%, 70%, then 90%, and then 94%. I mean, who in the hell is going to work when the government takes 94%? That's not counting state taxes. You saw that during the Great Depression in Hollywood. Actors would only make one movie because after 100,000, basically the government took 90% of what you made. So why in the heck would you want to make another movie and give basically everything you make to government? And so that is a mistake. And I think the ultimate outcome of all of this is going to be an inflationary outcome. And that's something that investors in the markets aren't ready for.
So as always, Jim, when we're talking about the risk of inflation and some of the policy mistakes, what does an investor do in this type of environment? How does one prepare for some of the risks that you are outlining?
You know, Chris, I think the old kind of diversification allocation strategy that was in place for two or three decades, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, I don't think that's going to work. In fact, there was a great article in Barron's this week by J.P. Morgan's head, one of their head strategists, and she was talking about, you know what, we're probably looking more like 80-20 going forward, because bonds, I mean, if you take a look at 10-year yields, are close to 0.5%. If you take a look at 30-year bonds, they're moving towards 1%. Wait till they get below 1%. Are you going to tie up your money for 30 years at less than 1%? And with the Fed intervening in the corporate bond market, even corporate bond yields aren't compensating investors for risk. So, you know, the things that we're doing is we're short-term bonds, we're inflationary assets. I mean, it's a must that you have precious metals. I mean, we moved into precious metals early on last year. We added silver, and then we've added platinum and also high dividend paying stocks. I mean, if I can get 3.5 to 6%, and that goes up every year, I mean, in our income fund, 13 of our stocks have raised their dividends this year, anywhere from 3-1 stock raised their dividend 80%. That's what you're going to need. You're going to need to maintain your purchasing power going forward, because if you don't, you're going to be in deep trouble.
Well, Jim, when it comes to our corporate cash management account, the income fund that we've been discussing, and even what we're doing with clients and precious metals and select commodities, how can our listeners get a hold of you or any of our investment advisors to take advantage of some of these things that we are doing at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
They could call us direct toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Well, that wraps up this week's show. Boy, I tell you, I mean, Chris, it's every single day you turn on the news. I mean, the stuff that is coming out, of course, this is a political election year, so you're going to expect, you know, it's going to be an ugly, ugly drag down fight, I think, in October. So expect some surprises, but certainly a lot of news-filled events almost on a daily basis.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour. Don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour and the wide range of guest experts, investment strategists, and book authors that we speak with on a regular basis, some of the top thinkers in the industry. Again, we do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.